reality. He's continuing the third section, people.
I'm getting way off the track, I can tell already. The role of the social prophet. We're going to talk a lot about the history of prophecy in Israel, actually. Only because my head is full of that. I've been studying that for about 3 weeks. And I'm going to inflict that on you. So, why don't we open with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you so much for your love for us, your revelation, your disclosure of your heart to us, the fact that you have given us this owner's guide to life in this book, the fact that we don't have to stumble around in darkness, that you tell us the way things work because you want us to be happy. You want us to experience all the beauty and the joy that you build into relationships, that you built into creation, that you built into your disclosure to us. Forgive us when we run and hide. And we just pray, Lord, that you would open our eyes today, that we would see the awesome power and the abilities that you have built into just day-to-day life for experiencing relationships with you and with images of you and other people and just the robustness of our day-to-day experience. And we pray, Lord, that we would take this leverage opportunity seriously and that we would delight in it and that we would also use it for your glory, for the honor of your Son, for his that there be more images of his love and his grace running around the universe by the time we finish this. We ask this for his sake. Amen. Okay, we are, let me get my bionic aids out here. There we go. Click. We are supposedly, I think, I had to ask Lambert, and he didn't know either, where we left off the last time the bus stopped. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was on page 4. Page 4 of 7. I think we're on bullet E called leverage. Okay? We had covered, for those of you that, haven't been here during the series, we have been going through a couple of different sections of reality. First, we started with God. We looked at the character of God. We did a portrait, basically, of God. What were the things he liked? What were the things he disliked? What were the things that he was really concerned about? What things did he cut slack on? Things of this type. We looked at a portrait of God. Then we looked at a snapshot of the universe. We talked about how it was fixed. But it still had a flexible character to it. There were things you could do in it. You could rearrange it. It was running down. There were aspects of it that were problematic. And then we got into this third bus stop. We focused in on people. And we're now describing people, and we talked about one of the fundamental aspects of people were that we were community, that we were built to look like the Trinity. We are face-to-face with other individuals, but we act like them. We mimic them. Children are spring-loaded to start acting like the folks for good or ill. They start imitating behavior that they learn at school. They imitate behavior that they learn at home. They absorb this. There are places, we'll see a little bit later, where they start to say no to that. We'll talk about the first adolescence, second adolescence, and midlife when we get a little bit further, where God builds into us specifically to question all the stuff that we brought into our lives and say, have I made the right choices? Have I made the right choices? I don't want to be slavishly dependent upon environment and heredity, let's say. We'll look at some of those elements. We looked at the fact that we were creatures, that we were not God. As somebody pointed out, there wasn't a vacancy in the job offering for God, that fortunately God was in place, and we just have to learn how to work in that context and to take advantage of that. And we're now at the point called leverage. And leverage is a management term, as most of you would probably know, and that's where you try to stand at some point with a lever, and you do more work with a lever than if you try to lift it up yourself. So for those of you that reached back and went to school in junior high, when I was in junior high back a couple years before the flood, we learned what simple machines were, the rock and tackle and the lever and the hoist. There were a couple of basic pieces of leverage where you could do more with a tool if you could use it like a lever. And so the concept of leverage in management science in management practices, where you get sort of, you use buttons, and you push knobs, and you dial things, and you get more out of it than what you theoretically put in it. And so the leverage concept is where if I can do one thing and it counts for two, or it does three things, I have leverage. And so the section we're going to talk about, we're on now, is about leverage, how the fact that we are built as community after the image and likeness of a Trinity, the fact that we're sort of stuck in this together, the fact that humans are dependent upon one another. We gave examples of the fact that we of alone of all the species of life forms are just so helpless for such a long period of time after birth. Remember, we talked about the fact that we aren't self-sufficient, you know, until long after we're making noise upstairs. Okay, long after junior high, I mean, we can start defending ourselves about 10. 8 to 10, you get some street life that works. Okay, about 8 to 10, you can make something work. You can live on your own if you had to. You could forage. But that's a long time compared to kittens and dogs and monkeys and cattle and all this kinds of stuff, right? The point is, we're built to be forced to be dependent upon one another. We are built to be forced to have to depend upon one another and develop relationships of trust. We are forced to do this, and it's a good thing we are, otherwise we would never trust God. You got to start somewhere. There's some learning that's associated with that. So, with that context, we come into, on page 4, bullet E called leverage. And there are a couple of sub-bullets, and the first one is that leverage is created by community. The fact that we are in this together, okay, gives us an opportunity for what's called leverage. Now, the first point there is called role of the social prophet. And I'm going to try not to use the entire time on this, but let me talk about what prophecy was in Israel, because this is the model that we've got. If you remember when Moses gave them the law, and so there's a little bit of history in here too. So you got Abraham comes out of, Abraham comes out of Mesopotamia and goes over into Palestine, right? He goes over there, he has a bunch of kids, they get up about a family size of around 70 folk, they go down to Egypt. They go into slavery to Egypt a little over, right around 400 years. They come ripping out with Moses, takes them out of slavery. About two million of these folk leave, wander around in the desert around here for about 40 years, come up along the Sea of Jordan and come into the land of Palestine. Okay? As they're going into the land of Palestine, which God had promised to Abraham and his kids, as they're going into the land of Palestine, Moses stops them on the other side of the Jordan and says, now before we go any further, you got to understand why God is getting rid of these other people and pushing them out. Why he's forcing them to go north, forcing them to go into Trans-Jordan, and forcing them to go south. He's just sort of squeegeeing the folk out of the land, evicting them, and putting them in. And the reason is because of what they do, what those people do. They do child sacrifice, they do lots of bad things that I'd rather not mention today, but you can read it right in here. Lots of bad stuff, okay? I don't want this to be an R-rated sermon. Yeah, okay? All right, so they do lots of these things, but let me tell you what. If you do the same thing that they do, guess what I will do to you? I'll squeeze you out just like I did then. There is no favoritism with God. Okay? Very, very clear. And what did they end up doing? Same thing as the nations around them. Did they get squeezed out? Absolutely. It's called Assyrian captivity. It's called the Babylonian captivity. So they're over there. Moses has got him sitting there. Before you go in, let me tell you what's going to happen here. And so he sets out the law that God had given them in Sinai. Remember, God had appeared in the mountain, the desert of Sinai, and a couple other times in there, and had given all of these commands in the law. Said, don't do this, do this, do this, please this, you know. And it was all based around one subtle thing. It was called the law of love. It says, love does no harm to its neighbor, and that's consistently throughout the Old Testament law. It's not predominantly about rituals and things of this type. That's in there. So that's a part of what God's message was. But you had more commands about take care of the alien, the fatherless, and the widows than you have about all the sacrifices combined. You have more demands upon social justice, more demands upon benevolent treatment of God's people than you have of all the other stuff. When they get going bad, okay, when they go into the land under Joshua, they seem to do semi-okay. They're doing okay. Joshua takes them in. They take over some of the land. They don't obey God most of the way, but they take over some of it. And then right after Joshua dies, you get what book? Judges. Now, is Judges a high water mark or a low water mark? Low water mark for Israel. Really, really bad time for Israel. The experience. This is the period of Judges. Well, in Judges, they go ahead and they absorb all the culture around them, and God starts the discipline process. And so he raises up a group of people called prophets, and all they are reminders that said, guys,
this is what he said. Just look here. That's all you have to do. Just pay attention. Follow instruction. Just follow instruction. When they went into the land, remember, one of the first things they did was they made two monuments. You remember these? They put a monument up here and a monument up here. And says, if you just simply obey God, that's all it is. Okay? Obey God, you get all these blessings. But if you don't, if you act like the folk that I just pushed out and evicted, this is what will come on you. The blessings and curses. They built a monument there. No discussion. Everything was clear. It was cascading discipline. If you don't listen to me the first time, I'll speak a little louder. If you don't listen in, I'll speak a little louder. There's a lesson for today, by the way, for those of you that have been through this before. Four lashes, then eight, and then six. We know how this works. Right? Okay. And so there's these cycles. And the prophets, the whole book, all the prophets are 80% forthtelling and 20% foretelling. We normally think of prophets and say, here's what's going to happen. On Tuesday, you're going to get up and you're going to wear blue socks, Glenn. That's foretelling. Foretelling is that when you get up Monday, you had better be ready to serve the Lord, Glenn. That's foretelling. See the difference? One is confrontational. One is exhorting. One is encouraging. One is confronting them with sanity. That's all it was. We're just confronting them with sanity. Look, you've got a sweet deal here with Yahweh. All you have to do is walk humbly with your God, be good to one another, and pay attention. That's all you've got to do, and you get all these blessings. It's a sweet deal. Don't mess this up. Don't mess this up. Okay? And that's what the prophets were supposed to do. So, but things didn't work out well for Israel at that particular point. And so Israel went to the period of Judges, and it went down sort of from there. Now, God raised up leaders for them, David, you know, raised up prophets. But the prophets would come back, and when they reminded them of the law, okay, did they focus more on the fact that they didn't do the rituals right or that they didn't treat their fellow Israelite right? The latter. It was always that. God never had a complaint with them. If they were being good to one another and they were doing the stuff, he never complained about them missing a Passover. Never mentioned about them not going to Jerusalem three times a year. If they were treating one another. Matter of fact, you find more grace in the law. It's unbelievable. The exceptions that God made to the commandments that he gave down when there was an exigency for this. When Aaron's sons died, Aaron was supposed to go on with the sacrifice. And Moses confronted him and Aaron said, you were supposed to do this thing. And Aaron said, look what happened to me today. Do you think God would be pleased with me doing this today? And Moses said, good point. And God didn't strike Aaron down, didn't deal with Aaron on that basis. See? When the holy bread, David was running from Saul. Remember, he was fleeing for his life. He comes over there to one of the places where the holy bread was. He's not allowed to eat the bread. Remember, Jesus is going to mention this later, right? He goes in there. He's not supposed to touch this bread. Not at all. But he was hungry, and there was grace. There was grace there. Okay? Sabbath was not made, you know, we were not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. It was supposed to help us not be a religious ritual. See, we were supposed to not work on that day. We were supposed to take it off. They weren't even allowed to let their servants work on Sabbath. Nobody was supposed to work. They were supposed to sleep in the whole day. Right? And they could only walk, 9/10 of a mile, and then you had to fall down and take another nap. I mean, this is the perfect... I could sign up for this. I mean, this is not a bad scenario. Okay? Now, the thing was is that the prophets kept calling them back to the essence of the law. Look, I didn't bring you out of slavery for you to enslave one another. But if you look at the history of prophecy, if you stack up the prophets in the order, not in the order there in the Bible, but in the order they were chronologically. So you start with Joan, and then you go to Amos, and you go and then you end off at Joel and Malachi. You'll see this progressive degeneration of the elite in Israel. Everybody starts oppressing. They start buying people. They go back to slavery. They don't let the slaves go at the end of 6 years, which was a mandatory requirement. They were forced to do that. They didn't cancel the debts every 7 years that they were supposed to do. You know, all the things that were built in there for the disadvantaged, they left. They didn't do. And so when the prophets come up, two of the prophets will, by the way, when the prophets first sort of started, right, they're back in 1 and 2 Samuel. You get Samuel was a prophet. And so you got the prophets there, and there's a school of the prophets with Elijah and Elisha. Okay, and they're outgrowing. They have a building program, too. You know, they said this place is too small for us.
They confronted Elisha, said this place is too small. So they have a building campaign in there to try to move to larger prophetic schools. Those were seminaries back in those days. And so there's this prophetic institution that goes all the way through biblical history. But once you get a king, guess what? He hires prophets. He hires prophets to do things for the king. He's on the king's payroll. So then you get what's called court prophets. And you can see where this is going. You know where this is going, right? These are paid political announcements by the local self-installed deities, okay? The local monarchs, right? And so you'll have two of the prophets in the Bible. The prophets in the Bible are not court prophets, by the way. They are the dissidents. They are the militants. They are the fringe element, okay? And they are the ones who got published. Okay. Also, okay. God says the court prophets, none of them are going to make it in the final edition of this book. The ones that made it are all the ones that got killed for their position. They all died violent deaths that we know, with the possible exception of Ezekiel and Daniel. They all generally died violent deaths at the hands of the ruling authorities. So much so that Jesus could make a sarcastic remark about this. About the fact that it was always the religious rulers that killed prophets. Prophets didn't die from natural causes. They died from the religious establishment. So Jesus is up in Galilee before his last trip to die for the crucifixion. And he tells his disciples in one little ironic remark, he says, well, we have to go to Jerusalem now because God forbid that a prophet should die outside of the city of Jerusalem. Right? So he makes this little comment. He says that just wouldn't be appropriate for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem. And so there's a little ironic sarcasm there about reflecting upon the fact that this is the way it sort of happened. The religious rulers and the leadership always were the one that did the prophets in. Well, the prophets made it. The prophets made it. But you have two of the prophets that when they started out in the book, they sent out, let me say this first, I am not a prophet. I'm a shepherd or I'm a vineyard person. Or I'm in agribusiness, or something of this type. They say, I'm not a prophet, and by that they're trying to differentiate themselves, distinguish, I'm not a paid political announcement. Right? I'm not on the payroll of anybody. Okay? Now, I don't want to downplay all, there was a court prophetess, Huldah, one of the women prophets in the Old Testament, that was an outstanding, and she was apparently on the payroll. Her husband kept the wardrobe for the king. He was a cosmetician. Kept the wardrobe for the king, but anything really important they went to Huldah for. And so when they found apparently what was the book of Deuteronomy, they discovered it in the temple, and they didn't know what to make of this thing. They took it over to Huldah and says, is this authentic, and what does it mean? And she's a court prophet, prophetess, but she is not what we would call, I guess in today's vernacular, would be a yes person. She's not a yes person. So she says, if you don't do this, you will die. And we will lose the... It is authentic. First, answer your first question is yes. The answer to the second question is, we're in deep yogurt. Okay, if you don't straighten up, King, and we don't do revival here, we're not going to survive as a nation. Okay, so the court, not all the court prophets were necessarily banned, but generally they were not they did not call the people back to the law. They did not call the people back to the instruction book that was to happen. So during this period, if you read the minor prophets, you will consistently see them taking on the ruling class, the elite, the rich, whatever, because that's where the abuses were. People that had power in those days abused it progressively over time. Men, women, even the aliens in the land are singled out. Even one time, widows, poor widows, were being abusive and were singled out in the prophets. Everybody goes bad in this model, okay? There's a lesson there for us, okay, too. It's just, we're all going to deal with this problem individually, okay? The prophets were there to call them back from that. It says, treat the people fairly. Deal with this issue. God does not want this abusive treatment going on. And so the main reason that the land was defiled was bloodshed. It was bloodshed, literal and figurative bloodshed in the land, abusiveness, okay? Now, the reason this fits in this context, okay, is that that's a leverage model. The community was supposed to support the people. Okay, if you look at how the law was set up, it was built so that the community would be self-sustaining. Okay, God starts out one of the passages, he says, there should not be any poor among you. Because if everybody plays with the program, the blessings will be more than you can deal with. You'll have a problem where to store it all if everybody walks straight. If you just do this, everything works. But, second half of the chapter, since you're not going to do this, there will be poor. Here are the provisions that I have made for the poor. First of all, and he gives a number of regulations that he's got for basically social welfare. Okay, he says, for example, when you farm, when you go over your crop, you're not allowed to do the borders. You can't do the borders. You leave whatever's out there around the edges for the poor. Okay, when you harvest your crop the first time, don't go back over it a second time to get the other stuff. You know, what you missed the first time, leave it for the poor of the land. Okay. If somebody becomes poor and they need room and board and a job, okay, you can allow them to sell themselves to you for 6 years as a servant. You are not allowed to treat them as a slave. You cannot treat them ruthlessly. They are not your property. If you kill them, you die. If you beat them, and they die, you die. The punishment was the same for if you punished an Israelite citizen, same thing. No differences there. And you're forced to let them go at the end of 6 years. And when they leave, you have to give them some of your flocks. You got to give them your food, give them liberally out of all your possessions. Okay? So they could buy themselves back anytime. Anytime. They were completely redeemable, etc. Forgive every debt every 6 years for the poor of the land. If there's debt at the end of 6 years, years of Jubilee and the year of the Sabbath years, cancel them all. You weren't allowed to charge a profit on food to the poor. You had to sell food at cost to the poor. Okay, and there are a number of things like this. Sacrifices weren't the same. It was a staggered sacrificial system, so to speak. So normally you had to do a sheep or a goat, but if you're poor, you could do a dove. If you were really poor, you could offer a Twinkie. You could offer some little pastry or something, a Danish or whatever. Okay. It was according to where you were. There was so much grace, so much built into this system to avoid these problems of oppression and things of this type. It's amazing. There were no laws like this in the ancient Near East, even remotely close to this level of benevolence. And God told Israel, says, look, I'm going to give you some laws that will make you look different from all the other nations. You will look like good folk. You will show love. By that, all people will know you are my disciples, the way you treat one another. They just didn't do it either. They didn't do it either. Okay? And so in this model, it was all built in there to be a beautiful, beautiful thing. And so when you start messing with that, the whole thing gets out of whack because of leverage. All it takes is one abusive comment to somebody to set things in motion. You know this yourself in personal relationships. One strange word, you know, one strange look early in the morning sets an avalanche in motion sometimes, right? This is called leverage. And the social prophet in Israel was about that. It was trying to call leadership, those that had means, those that had abilities, those that had responsibilities, to get back on track and start the leverage going in the other direction. Because it was a spiral. If you did good, you got more back than you sowed. I mean, it's part of what agriculture is a model of. Sowing and reaping is a model of the fact that if I sow one good thing, I'm going to get more than one back. You know, there's the leverage model. It's the multiplication model. See, this is the way it works, for good or ill. If somebody in the Old Testament law stole something, when they gave it back, they didn't give just it back. They had to increase it by 20%. See, because there was a loss factor associated with it. Some cases, they had to restore fourfold. Okay, because you did damage. You took somebody's sheep and killed it, you had to replace it with four. If you stole it and then returned it, you just have to give them a fourth of a sheep. I think it would be a lamb chop or something. I don't know how that works. But there was recognition built in that there was leverage, that this stuff cascaded through time, that it made a difference downstream. And the social prophet, the vast majority of our Old Testament, remember, is that prophecy stuff. You know, Isaiah and all the way through here. Because they're trying to call people back to recognize that the power that you have in community for good or ill. You can turn people away from the Lord by the way you treat them. You can force them to do things that they would not do under normal circumstances, okay, because of situations that you place them in. There's a powerful leverage model there. Now that's the social prophet. And by the way, if you look at the quotations of the law in the prophets, that's what they do. The reason it's in my head right now is I finished yesterday just for the think tank. It's not posted yet, but Old Testament quotes or citations within the Old Testament. Okay, not Old Testament, the New, which we already have plenty of this stuff on. But I've got 230 that's just the top of the iceberg where the Old Testament is either quoted or cited in the Old Testament. And if you look at how many times the stories from the Mosaic Law are cited by the prophets, they're always just pointing back to that. They're not doing anything new. They're not starting anything new. They keep pointing back and saying, look, just do this. All you got to do is this. You know, quit oppressing. You know, take care of the tithes. Remember, they go into these things about the tithes. Sometimes later in the book, in the prophets, they go and they say, well, you guys aren't bringing the tithes in. See? And when you ask, well, that seems a bit mercenary, isn't it? I would say, nothing's changed there, you know, in terms of the money ethic, right? And the point is, when you said, and therefore my people have nothing to eat. Because every third year, all of the tithes were supposed to go into the cities for poor relief. For the alien, the fatherless, and the widow in the land, and the Levites that didn't have land per se. That's what it was for. Every first year, all of the tithes was to be for social relief. And so God says, you're not bringing this in, so guess who's not eating? Guess who's not eating? See? So it's not just a matter of you're not keeping your commitment. That's a separate problem, okay? But it's that you aren't taking care of the responsibilities I gave you as a community. Okay? So the role of the social prophet was to take advantage of this leverage and call people back that had the ability to do something about this. Okay, and then and it only works because of this leverage. It only works because of this leverage. Okay, it was when that was. I think it's Isaiah's got the passage in there about the fast when he says, "You people fast, but you missed the point. Is not this the fast I have chosen to take the food that you would have eaten, okay, and give it to the poor?" See, that's a different kind of fasting model that we normally think of. We normally will fast for discipline reasons, you know, try to whip ourselves back into shape after periods of binges, okay? And so we'll just say, well, no, I'm sorry, I've got to start saying no to the hot fudge sundaes, at least for a week. No more hot fudge sundaes this week. For a week, I got to teach my body who's in control of this thing, right? Okay. And that wasn't a tip for anybody to bring me any kind of hot fudge sundaes next Sunday, okay? But anyway, you get the picture here. It's a matter of saying no. But his was, when you're going to do a fast, take what you're denying yourself and give it to somebody who needs it. We will see the same problem, by the way, when we get to the New Testament in communion services. Remember, they had the Last Supper. They actually had a meal. They had the fellowship meal, remember, before they had communion. They would literally have a love feast to celebrate the unity they had in Christ. And the problem was, of course, is that the rich people would get there 3 hours early because they weren't working, and the urban poor would get there 3 hours late, okay, because they were working late. They had to work late. And the problem was is that, in this case, the elite got a six-hour head start on the food and wine. And so Paul says, now look, when you come together, some of you get there early, you eat all the food, and you're drunk by the time the rest of us get there. You know? Something's out of whack with this process, okay? And that, so it continues on into our day, of course, from that standpoint. So there's a tremendous amount of power, and God calls us in the community back to taking advantage of the leverage structures that we've got. Now, point B is all the power of peer pressure and public opinion. Now, this is one of the stranger things about the way God built us, is the fact that there's this thing called common grace. Theologians talk about common grace. It's goodness that God has built in to systems, built into the things that we do and the way we interact, regardless of whether we're Christian or not. Okay, there are things that are built into just the structures of human experience that try to move us in the proper direction. Now, I gave an example, remember, of kids being built to mimic and imitation, that the eyes go open, the ears go on, and they start imitating behavior automatically. Just boom, boom, boom. They just start picking it up, right? That's a common grace structure. That's built to make us into community. That's built to move us into robustness and develop our capabilities. That would be a common grace structure. It doesn't matter whether the kid is a Christian or not at age one. Doesn't make a lot of difference, okay? It's just, boom, right out of the gate, wham, the structure cuts out, okay? Well, there's these structures called peer pressure, okay? And most of you are aware with these. And they're not all bad. We normally think of them in bad senses about me being forced to conform to behavior. But it's, a lot of times it's not necessarily a bad thing. It could be just a way of stealing good ideas. I remember telling my my teenagers when they got in the age of where they were going to sort of discount everything Dad said, right? So, you know, all of my, the old dog's old tricks, right, are not worth assuming. And I remember sitting down and telling them, like, one of the first things you need to learn in life is to steal every good idea you can find. Okay. Every good idea that's working for somebody, use it if you can. Don't reinvent the wheel. For those of us that have reinvented the wheel over and over and over, don't do this, okay? Just, if you find a good idea and there's no copyright infringement law, steal the idea. Go use this thing, right? It will save you more grief, and that's part of what peer pressure is about. If there's, it's what's called statistical pressure, right? If there's 50 other people in the room doing something, that making a decision, and I'm facing that decision and have not made that before, right? That's called prima facie evidence, first face evidence, that I ought to consider that as an option, okay? Now, this works against us and for us, and I was reminded of a comical thing that literally happened this morning. I'm driving in the rain, right? And so I've got my windshield wipers on intermittent, you know, where it pauses and does the little thing and then waits and then, but it's at that borderline whether you don't know whether to use intermittent or go for the aggravation of this. You know, you don't know whether the squeak is just going to drive you crazy and you're going to lose your mood before you get to church and all because of this irritation. You know, if you wanted this irritation, you could have waited a day and get back to the office. You know, but you know, this is going, you don't know that. So I'm at a red light, right, and I'm trying to sort of make this decision. I'm thinking of a thousand things, and I glance over and there's this van over here that's got theirs on intermittent. And without thinking, I put it back to intermittent. I leave it on intermittent. And then 40 feet through the intersection, I realized what I just did. I made this decision on the basis of some other car was doing, without thinking, any validation, I didn't think, were they just as big a fool? Were they looking at my intermittent? Were they watching mine, the fact that mine was on intermittent? And they made the decision before I had time to glance over there? You know, before you get in that level of paranoia, which I am wont to do personally. I realized that that's what it is. I just looked around to check, you know, and it wasn't necessarily a pathological thing. I wasn't worried about rejection in case they looked over. He said, who's this bozo got this thing? How does he deal with that irritation? He must like it, you know, whatever. Right? It wasn't that kind of thing. But I recognized there that there is this structure. When you take, for example, a minority position in academia, when you go against the consensus, you have to have four times the amount of argument and data that the other side has to have. See, it's because you think, what am I missing? See, there's something that's missing here that everybody else sees that I don't see. And so that's a healthy thing in terms of checks and balances. That's not a bad thing per se. It's used as a bad thing, as God says in the Old Testament in the book of Proverbs, not to follow the crowd. If the crowd is doing evil, don't go there. It's the old thing we heard, you know, if everybody else is jumping off the cliff, Glenn, are you going to jump off too? Well, it depends if they've got a bungee cord on, Mom. It depends on how this works, right? You try to get out of those. But it's that kind of model to where peer pressure works because of structures built into us. Remember that imitative thing? We are literally built to be unity. For good or ill, we are built to become one. These are structures in us that try to promote unity within the faith, unity in the race, or unity in our families and things. It's built for this, and that's part of what peer pressure is about. And it's something that, in some cases, those that do social engineering and things of this type try to use these structures around us. And as a business executive, I use these all the time. I know how this works, and you build consensus, and then you let momentum of an organization carry you, and all the things that you just take advantage of common grace structures. It's not rocket science. Unless you work in the aerospace industry. But other than that, it's not that complicated a thing. It's just we're built to do these things. We are built to like those that like us. We are built to be successful at the things we do well, and we do well at the things we are successful at. You know, there are these things that are built. And so all these, you know, 12 steps to success and how to be positively successful, there's nothing new in that that's not already generally in here. You know, you have to do some, but it's easier to get people to read those books than it is to read this book, because there are also some moral injunctions in here that confront us at the face level. God wants to be in our face, to use the vernacular in some cases. Because we will take some of these social structures and these peer structures and these abilities and misuse them, what the social prophets were about, right? The scribes, for example, in the Old Testament, they did contracts. They did contracts on the basis of the law. And Jeremiah has to call them into account. He says, because you pervert the law, you scribes. Because you twist it, because the folks that they were doing contracts couldn't necessarily read the law. It was inaccessible. The scrolls. That's why you don't have chapter and verse quotes in the Old Testament of the Old Testament, because it was all scrolls. You know, there's no spaces in between the words. There was no punctuation, no verse and mark. So you just couldn't say, Jeremiah, about three quarters of the way through the roll, over somewhere two thirds of, you know, because by the time you rolled it out, it's like fast forwarding through a cassette tape. You know, by the time you get there, the argument's changed, right? So you didn't do a lot of that, and so the scribes had a lot of power to falsify, not the documents, but just what they said. See, they weren't out there, the lying pen of the scribes, the prophet called the lying pen of the scribes, because they'll write what law was being quoted, you know, in some of the documents in the Ostraca. And so they'll change it ever so slightly. The Christian church did that, of course, 400 AD and later. We did the same thing. We'll change documents. Fortunately, God provided us enough manuscripts to catch that before 400 AD. So we were able to catch how people tried to change the New Testament after 400 AD. So in this kind of model, peer pressure is to it's one of the things that we have to work with. We have to recognize that if you take a leadership position for Jesus Christ in your family, in your work, in your relationships, in your secondary social groups, okay, you will create pressures, quote unquote, influences, models that will move the group forward. Generally speaking, it will move the group forward incrementally. I often use the example of, remember, starting an avalanche one rock at a time. One rock at a time are what avalanches are made out of, okay? And so in a group, you just literally 5 minutes of overt, not obnoxious Christian behavior, but just taking a stance and living it out in 5 minutes moves the thing that much further. Okay, sometimes it will move the group away from you. Okay, if you do it right, depending upon the group. Okay, it will move, but it will define the positions that much more clearly, and people will understand. I remember. I became a Christian as a junior in college and gave my life to the Lord that following summer. I was out in Kansas City selling books door to door and went back as a senior in college against my will. And I remember back at the fraternity house. I was an officer in our fraternity. It was a good old social southern fraternity. And I ran the house. I was I did the management of the house and the funds and the finances for the organization. And I remember that I was just constantly getting picked on by the frat brothers, not to mention a couple of college professors that would single you out in class. That's a separate problem, okay? I've got scars to show you from those. Okay. But I remember one time one of the main social guys in the fraternity had a tragedy or something in his life or his family or something like, and he came and sought me out at like 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, I live in the center of the house where all the functions were. And so he knocked on the door, and I went in his room, and he said, when we are in groups of three or more, we make fun of you. But when we are in groups of two or less, we know you have your act together. Using that, I mean, the phrase of the 60s, right? You have your act together. Right? And, of course, I had no idea that this was how the perceptions were, right? You know, this is what God does. It's just, you take a stance. It doesn't matter whether you don't think anybody's getting the message or not, right? If that's not your job. Your job is to take the stance, keep your nose clean before God, walk humbly, lovingly, as a servant, focus on the needs of, that's what the job is. Communication is somebody else's task. That's the Spirit's job in the New Testament, at least. So, in this kind of model, you still have in the powers, those structures, both the common grace one and then any extra ones that the Holy Spirit wants to put on within the structures to do it. It may define it differently, but like I said, the message will become clearer. Something will be different about the organization, one, and especially about the members in it, if you do that right. If your stance is clear and humble before the Lord. Like I say, you're not, you know, being obnoxious about the stuff that you do. And you have to watch this about, you know, you have to watch the obnoxious character, because it's too easy, the messenger and the message problem that we've got in the way we do it. I remember somebody, an old Christian, once I became a Christian and got that flaming evangelism thing and did more damage in the first year with family and friends. You know, I'm still picking shrapnel out, you know, those relationships 20-something years later. But somebody had said that they ought to take every new Christian and lock them up for a year. Literally lock them up for a year, feed them the Bible, feed them examples of people that have been walking with the Lord 30, 40 years, you know, so that they see, oh, this is where we're going, not this way. This is not, we're going to call fire down on the prophets of Baal. We're not going to do those kinds of things, okay? So it's like, I remember, Jesus takes his crew through Samaria one time, right? So they were constantly making this trip from Galilee, northern Israel, to Jerusalem in southern Palestine, right? So they were constantly making this. And one time they went through through Samaria, and his disciples came up and said, well, the Samaritans mistreat us. Should we call fire on them, Lord, from heaven? And you know, you can just see Jesus looking back over and say, you guys just don't get it. You just don't get this yet. You know, I did not come to judge the world. I came to save it. Judgment's a little later. We'll get to that. Right now we're trying to buy as much time for people as we possibly can. That's why I'm delaying all the judgments as I possibly can, so I let as many people as come to their senses as possible. I'd like to populate the kingdom with as many people as possible. So I'm going to hold off calling fire down on folk until we get, you know, toward the very end, until we get to the book of Revelation thing. So, and this is the kind of model that occurs. We want to do the opposite thing. We want to sow love. We want to overcome evil with good. Okay? All right, so that's point B, all the power of peer pressure and public opinion. Public opinion is just a fancy version of peer pressure. Okay, same kind of thing. What's interesting is that we will make this decision long before the peer pressure occurs. Okay, so you think about this, right? You're thinking about doing something, and you go ahead internally and role play how it's going to be perceived. Normally, you don't wait and try this out on a trial basis. Sometimes you try that new shirt on. Sometimes you try that tie. Sometimes you try that new expression, okay, things of this type. But normally you think, what do I think the response is going to be? You do what's called a thought experiment. You do a trial run inside. You visualize the outcomes. You visualize alternative futures, okay, long before you launch the program, okay, long before you try the thing out. So we are built to think in terms of, authors do this when they write. An author will take the role of both self or herself and the audience will write this thing, and they'll look at this and say, you know, that's not what I meant to say. They're reading it through a separate set of eyes from another audience's eyes. So we're built to have this capability to anticipate this as, in some cases, a corrective. And the corrective comes in point C, social and cultural pressures and control mechanisms, okay? So sometimes negative peer response is a control tactic. It was supposed to be this way. See, in Israel, if the whole world is good, okay, and you're bad, you're going to get frowned on. And that's going to be peer pressure to at least encourage you to reconsider your position. Okay? The bad news, of course, is that we'll make hypocrites, right? Like, how many non-Mormons do you know that live in Salt Lake City that are in the business circles? Okay, there are strong cultural elements that have to do with religious preference, socioeconomic dynamics, things of this type that are associated with this. Okay, so there are things that will influence us to make decisions based upon these kinds of control pressures. And like I say, they will stop behavior. The Old Testament law said that because punishment was not executed on criminals swiftly, the whole nation has run to evil. See? when there's no consequences for moral choice that affect the community, then everybody sort of second guesses the law. How long can I get away with it? Right? I'm reminded by a cartoon that came out that showed this. It was in a jail cell, and so you have like an attorney and the criminal, just a middle-aged business type sitting there in a cell, and the criminal is saying, "Well, yes, DNA testing has been known to prove innocence, but not in the case of stock fraud." Okay. Or embezzlement. Okay, and so there's a whole category of crimes that we do and things that are more, that are more difficult in terms of consequences, in terms of how they show up. If you kill somebody, there's generally a physical trail of this. If you commit a financial indiscretion, there's an audit trail associated with that. But they all lead, all the trails lead somewhere. Okay, they always hit somebody else's face. Remember they taught us back in grade school that when you were sitting at it, it says your rights, I had the thing going, your rights end where another's begin. Remember they would tell us not to reach over and hit the other person, you know, the chair next to us. He said, your arm can only swing. I was just swinging my arms. You know, I was just stretching. You know, well, your stretch ends where their face begins. You know, that kind of model, right? In other words, there are boundaries defined in this, in the social and governmental structures that say here and no further. This is where you can go. And the whole system is built to adjust to that. So if crime goes this way, people get concerned about it, and then you get anti-crime measures, right? If laxity goes this way, then you get a movement to go back really strong in the other direction. Okay? If you get extreme legalism in the community, guess what? You get a swing back in the other direction, right? Because the answer is somewhere in the middle there, generally. In business, I talk about the pendulum of centralization and decentralization in organizations. It just goes back and forward, back and forward. In every organization, it goes just like this, large organizations. And it's in that middle that's basically where you're the most productive. Or effective, I think, as Lambert would remain. Okay? That's where you're actually getting the work out the door. And so it is in this scenario that things are literally built in for us to take advantage of. I have a case. I have a friend that is in an extremely abusive situation. Extremely family abusive, the worst I have ever seen or ever heard of, and I've been trying to get this person to go to the authorities for 2.5 years. Okay, won't do it. Fear's there, don't trust the authorities, don't believe they'll believe them. All the lies that they've been fed, you know, for 20-odd years is, you know, operative. It's what the intake was. There's been no counterposition. So I've been arguing for 2.5 years that says, no, somebody will believe you. There are some people that would decide that you are right and that the other individuals involved are wrong, okay? And that's hard to get through. Now, and so when I pray about the situation, I pray that God will break in with the authorities, see? When I pray specifically that he'll use the structures that were created that are somewhat disposable and deployable. The heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord as the rivers of water he turn it whithersoever he will. That's King James Version from Proverbs. I learned that as a young man very early. The first time I made a job change, I prayed that and saw a miraculous thing happen. I have since then applied that. I've said, you know, Paul sat there and says, you got oppressive governments? You still do it. You still work within the structure. Romans 13, you know. I mean, we'll get off into that a little bit later when we talk about authority structures. But the model is that they are there for some level of manipulation by God. He normally doesn't get involved, but he says, pray for your rulers that you can live lives of peace and quietness. In other words, you can move them around with prayer. You can get authorities involved because there's no such thing as a monolithic organization, I have discovered. There is no such thing as an organization that is all good or all bad. There are always pockets in there of anything, always. It doesn't matter how bad the church is, there's flaming evangelicals in there. Believe me, it doesn't matter how bad they are, because most of the time the people down below don't have a clue what they're supposed to believe. I find this all the time. I remember, literally, if you know what the four big cults are, you know, the four original big cults in America, on the think tank, I have a survey form where I come to this, who in your opinion is Jesus Christ? Would you consider yourself a Christian? What are the most influential books? What do you know? How much do you know about Christ's background? Things of this type. And when they come on to me on the screen, it comes in like four screenfuls. Right? So I get the first screen on the little TV monitor, right? It shows up there and it says their opinion of Jesus Christ and this kind of stuff. And then I hit page down, hit a little button to go to the second screen, which talks about what evidence do they have for their belief about Jesus. You know, is it personal experience or whatever this type? And the third screen down says, what books have affected you the most? You know, it's what do you read, you know, that have been the largest for affecting your opinion. So my expectation gets set from that first screen. When they talk about who Jesus Christ is, if they come in and say, my Lord and Savior, the person who died for me, who paid for my sins, I love him, I try to serve him every waking moment of my life, the Prince of Peace, you know, when it's, you get through with screen one, it may be a worship experience. You know, and old Glenn's in tears there, trying to pick himself off the ground, be able to see the screen through all this extra liquid that's in front of my pupils, right? And then you do page down, and it says, you know, how do you know this? Well, because I asked him in my life, you know, 20 years ago, and he's been walking, and he's answered these miracle repair, that blah, 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 blah. You page down, what book influenced you most? The Doctrine of Covenant, the Book of Mormon, Science and Health with the Key to the Scriptures. And so, now granted, I only get one of those every 6 months, but it still blows me away. Because you want to write them back and say, well, how much do you know about the Book of Mormon? How much do you know about Science and Health with the Key to the Scriptures? How much do you know about Doctrine of Covenant? Doctrine and Covenant. You know what I'm saying? And when you write them back, they say, well, I don't know a lot about it. I was just raised there. See, you could do the same thing about Baptist, Presbyterian, Independent Bible Church. You see what I'm saying? There are those that don't have a clue what they're, quote-unquote, paid to believe, supposed to believe. But they have an independent opinion. And so I have discovered that in just about every structure, government, business, whatever, there's always a pocket of folks that don't know why they're there, so to speak, you know. And they're dissenters, they're renegades, and it's those that you can sometimes ask God, would you use this in this situation? Would you use this? So if you're in a situation like that right now where you're over against an authority structure, where they have some power, real or implied, teachers, government, debtors, you know, I mean, all kinds of the structures that do have influence, claim the verse and go out there and says, Lord, I'll take what you give me out of this deal. I'll be content. You know, I'll accept the outcome. But I would like to claim this verse and have you make sure that the authority decision gets made correctly. That's what I want. I don't want it to go necessarily my way or that way or this way, whatever, because sometimes we're not sure how we need the outcome to go. That's a separate deal problem. But we would at least like to get God involved a little bit more. And so these structures are built, okay, in the universe for us to take advantage of and ask God, would you leverage this for your glory, for your honor, and for the accomplishment of your will. Every day I get up in the morning and I say, you know, Father, I call upon your name as Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God, that you keep your covenant promises to your son, your people, your church, and your world. Okay, I just ask that you would, your will be done on earth, that you would invade our space and eventuate the kingdom. Bring it to pass. Move it forward incrementally today, further than if we didn't do this prayer thing, God. Okay, just move it forward, one rock at a time, right? And it's these structures that get mobilized and energized in some cases about that. Persecution for Christians, you know, government intervention in special situations without making large-scale policy decisions. You know, there are enough exceptions that occur in the world to invoke this for God's glory. Okay? All right, we're going to have to wrap here. I told you we wouldn't get real far. We're obviously just on this leverage thing, but we're going but we'll probably make further ground next time because we're going to use leverage principles next time. All right, let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you so much that you have built this universe to support your causes. You have built these structures in our relationships, in our communities, in our church, in our organizations to function to help us not have to reinvent the wheel, that we could just move forward incrementally and do creative things, new things, good things. We can add value to people's lives, that we can serve them better. We can focus on meeting their needs because they're already focused on meeting ours. We don't have to worry about self-centeredness. We just pray that you would bless us this week, Lord, that we would use this, that we would operate in this, we would see all this in the light of your word, the light of your commitment to us, and the way you have designed the system to work. So we just pray, Lord, that for the situations that we may be confronted with as individuals, you know, bosses, in government situations, economics, whatever it is, Lord, structures and families, that you would help us to see that and count on you to use those, that we might leverage the message of Christ, that we might leverage righteousness, that we might leverage goodness and love further. Help us take a stand for you, stand for love, stand for good this week, and move our organizations and the members of the groups that we're in just a little bit further. Lord, help us put a rock out there for an avalanche of righteousness and an avalanche of praise to your Son. Help us put a rock out there this week. We ask it for his sake. Amen. Okay. Bingo. We are on...